Okay,
we'll see what's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they say it's the exact same spot, both sides, but I'm sorry, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Marlisa,
are you ready for this?
My cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc. UFOs over New York,
and I am too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and thanks for downloading this podcast, which is edition 433 of Strange Days Indeed. The program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This week, the 4th in March 2007, editorial contributor Dave Furlott, the Canadian representative for NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, and our East Coast correspondent, pilot Don Ledger, on the Phoenix Flares. French UFO researcher and author Gildas Bourdais fills us in on the recent release of UFO files by the French Space Agency. And our feature this week, Stanton T. Friedman and author of the new book, Shoot 'Em Down, Frank Fraschino. The title of the book is really provocative. Shoot 'em down. And Alfred Lemberg takes us home. These are strange days indeed. James Fox, creator of the Out of the Blue documentary, has started doing the rounds of major media outlets with former Arizona Governor Fife Symington. On Thursday of this week, ABC TV's Good Morning America used footage from the remake of Out of the Blue, along with the usual 10 p.m. flare footage, to get, whether deliberately or not, the facts wrong. The piece is edited to suggest that Symington witnessed the flares rather than the boomerang or chevron-shaped objects that hundreds saw earlier in the evening. The debunker's voice that you'll hear is that of UFO know-nothing, amateur astronomer, James McGahey. Here is the audio from ABC's Good Morning America.
Now to the question, are we all alone in the universe? Some say the proof is in this picture, lights that appeared over the Phoenix sky 10 years ago. Now at the time, Arizona's then governor claimed he didn't see it that way, but today he's singing a different tune. The Harvard grad and decorated Vietnam vet says those lights were the real deal. Am I kidding, John? Or is that what it was, right?
You are deadly serious, Chris. Good morning. You know, we often complain that our politicians don't understand the problems of real people. Well, maybe they do understand the problems of aliens. The former governor of Arizona now says he had his own personal close encounter.
For 6 years, Fife Symington was governor of Arizona. That's a state in America on planet Earth. Symington now says that while he was governor, he had a brush with something not from America or planet Earth.
It was just breathtaking. I mean, when I saw it, I thought, okay, you know, this is definitely a UFO. I've never seen anything like this in my life.
It was an event that is now the stuff of legend, called the Phoenix Lights. This is actual video taken in 1997 of those mysterious lights flying in formation in the Arizona night sky, as witnessed by thousands.
It was moving very slow. I went in and jokingly said to my wife, we got to
UFO coming over.
And it was definitely not an aircraft as we know it.
I saw a geometric form with extremely bright lights on the leading edge.
But this is a different story than Symington gave when he was governor. Then he held a fake press conference to present the source of the glowing lights. His chief of staff in a Martian costume.
Now this just goes to show that you guys are entirely too serious.
Symington now says that back then he was just trying to keep everyone calm.
What I was trying to do was have fun and make a spoof and stop all the public hysteria that was going on at the time.
Recently, there seems to have been a number of strange sightings, some with explanations, some without. In Washington last fall, a fireball lit up the sky. The government said it was the sun reflecting off a plane. In January, mysterious streaks in the Midwest turned out to be a falling Russian rocket. Skeptics say even the famed Phoenix lights can be explained away as a formation of military planes.
There simply is no evidence that a spacecraft from another world has ever visited the Earth. None.
But Governor Symington says he knows better.
But there's always that 5% of sightings which are just inexplicable. And it leads me to believe that there are definitely UFOs, and I'm totally open to the idea that whoever they are occasionally pass this way.
You know, a lot of people agree with Governor Symington. Just this week, France became the first country to put all of its X-Files online, about 1,600 alleged sightings over the last 50 years, more than 100,000 documents. And, Chris, there was so much interest, the site crashed within 2 hours.
I am not surprised. John Berman, thank you very much for bringing it to us.
Are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Berlock.
Available to almost anyone. That is, almost anyone that has access to the Internet. The Space Agency for France has created a place on the Internet where anyone can go and see all the files they have gathered over the last 5 decades on UFOs. The news has been greeted with everything from "It's the greatest thing since sliced fromage" to "Didn't they do something like that with that Comita report a few years ago?" Truth is, neither position would be accurate. Firstly, the Comita report was an unofficial civilian publication, and secondly, although the French Space Agency is France's equivalent to NASA in the United States, it is only one element of the French government with very minimal ties to the French military. In essence, the release of these files would be similar to when the USAF released the Project Blue Book files. Now, please do not think that I do not appreciate the French Space Agency releasing these documents to the public. I do. Matter of fact, I was probably one of the millions of people who tried to access the website when it was announced and subsequently brought the poor servers that were trying to keep up with the numbers to their knees. Incidentally, if you do try to access the site now, you will need two things: patience and the ability to read French. The address of the site is www.cnes-geipan.fr for France. What some noted ufologists have correctly pointed out about the release of these files is that they have similar numbers to Project Blue Book. Some 25 to 28% of the reports scattered by the French agency have been labeled as unknown. These reports are the ones that will be the most highly scrutinized by UFO researchers because there might be one in there that could be hiding the key to proving once and for all what the strange things flitting around in our atmosphere on a daily basis really are. The official position of France's space agency is that we do not have the least proof that extraterrestrials are behind the unexplained phenomena. But they also add, nor do we have the least proof that they are not. In other words, it's up to people outside of the agency to either prove or disprove any theory that the vehicles are from some other planet. Now, something that should be pointed out and has been very lightly touched on by posters to the UFO updates list about this release of French documents is that we should not expect that these files are the only files that the French military, the government, or French intelligence agency have on UFOs. Much like any government or military agency anywhere in the world, the French can just as easily stamp something as top secret, and the chances of you or I ever seeing the document actually become slim to none. Oh, and in case anyone believes that only North America can have intelligence agencies with alphabet names, the French have such agencies as the French Sûreté, DGSE, DRM, DPSD, BRGE, SCSSI, and EIEIO. Nah, last one isn't a French intelligence agency, but you get the idea. Now, I'm very pleased that the space agency in France has allowed these files to be made available on a worldwide basis. It's a lesson that NASA could afford to learn, because it would almost let me believe that NASA means it when they say they're exploring space for all humanity, instead of for just a few select military and government agencies. And maybe NASA wouldn't need to have spokespuppy Oberg come up with unbelievable fantasies about some of the things that have been seen or experienced and reported by former NASA personnel. Now, we've seen Brazil come forward and open their UFO reports from military and government files. We have the Freedom of Information Act access to some files from the United States and Great Britain. And we even have access to government files here in Canada. Now, we have some files made available from the space agency in France. All in all, this is good progress. But we still need more. We need access to everything that all the governments in the world know about UFOs. That information is our right to have, simply because we are the ones that live on this planet. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Interesting you should choose that as a topic for yourself this week, Dave, because I spent some time on Thursday talking with Gildas Bourdais over there in France about the very subject.
What can I say? It just came to me. We're beginning to now finally see some people come forward and say, okay, yeah, we do have some files. We do have some information. Here, take a look. Tell us what you think. Because, again, it's like anything else. The more we learn or the more that we get, there may be that jewel in the middle of all the rubbish that we can turn around and say, hey, this is something that we can really look at. We have an awful lot of reports of landed UFOs that we really haven't followed up on enough. If you take a look at some of the files from France, they're talking about, you know, reports of landed UFOs.
We had some of those in Quebec, too, as I said to Gildas.
Yes, some in Quebec. Yep. And I believe also we've had some out west, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
We haven't even scratched that yet.
No.
We need some more information from people like Ted Phillips who would trace aspects of all of these cases.
I'd like to get a hold of Ted. I've tried several times.
Mm-hmm.
Did you happen to see the Toronto Star last Saturday? They covered both the French release and Fife Symington down there in Arizona.
Oh, no, I didn't.
And I have it right here in front of me. It's from page 21 of last Saturday's Toronto Star.
Mm-hmm.
And the headline is, That Rotten Smell of Extraterrestrials.
That's something I've never heard before.
Well, and referring to the smell of sulfur.
Oh, yes.
It's often left behind when there have been visitations.
Ooh.
Hmm.
I think we're probably going to get into hearing from our friends, the demonologists, going, well, see, look, UFOs, demons for the 90s or 2000s.
Yes.
Hopefully not.
Would be good not. Dave, thank you, sir.
Oh, well, thank you.
And we'll talk to you again next week.
Most definitely.
And as always, a good take.
Thank you.
Bye, Dave.
Bye-bye. You're going to wish you had listened to some of these things that I...
Another contributor to this program is our Canadian correspondent, Don Ledger. He's the Canadian representative for the National Aviation Reporting Center on Aerial Phenomena down there in the United States. It's an organization that's been set up for pilots, air traffic controllers, that type of official job, to report anonymously on anything that they happen to come across in the aerial phenomena area. And I guess the big aerial phenomena story since you were last on, Don Ledger, has been the revelation that the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, himself had a sighting of one of those Chevron boomerang-shaped objects back on March 13th, 1997.
Yeah.
And, of course, a lot of the media climbed on the Phoenix Lights portion of that evening.
Yeah.
And suggested, by omission, that what he had seen were those flares that were dropped at around 10 o'clock on that evening.
Yeah.
Rather than the earlier sightings that happened between 7 o'clock and 8:30.
Right, yeah. Well, let's look at how effective that was, all right? Those lights have confused the newspapers no end, and Bruce McAbee, one of our regular listeners, has brought that point up that they always get it wrong, they always confuse the two, and it muddies up the waters on that particular sighting. The real hardcore portion of that event was between 7:30 and 8:30 that evening. And then all of a sudden, at 10 o'clock at night, the Air Guard, who were over there training in the area, one A-10 goes up and drops a pattern of flares in the sky. But where does he drop the flares so that they could be seen? He drops so they ignite at 25,000 feet. Now you say, well, okay, so they drop flares at 20,000 and they ignite at 25,000 feet. Well, flares dropped and igniting at 25,000 feet for an exercise on the ground, because that's what they're for, so that you can see enemy forces running around out there in the desert. You can't illuminate a light at 25,000 feet is absolutely no help whatsoever. You might as well be using the stars to illuminate the ground. 25,000 feet, these things are made to be effective between 500 and 1,500 feet above the ground. So, why would they drop flares so that they would ignite? That means you either drop them and they immediately ignited or drop them higher than that at 25,000 feet. Well, number one, 25,000 feet is just below the airspace extending out from Phoenix, which is Sky Harbor in Phoenix. If you look at the restricted airspaces, it builds up from the ground like an inverted wet eat cake. In other words, the smaller portion of the cake is at the ground in a circle, going out usually 7 to 10 miles, and then there's another one that goes out about 20 miles, and then one above that that'll go out about 50 miles. And depending on the number of airspaces they're controlling, and since Phoenix is the ninth busiest airport in the United States and the 18th busiest airport in the world, it has a fairly large air traffic control zone governing it. Another thing, Phoenix is slightly below sea level from what I understand, plus it's in a ring of mountains, a mountain range is around the outside of it, so that anything that was happening at 1,500 feet or below that, over at the Barry Goldwater range southwest of Phoenix, anything that would be happening up to even 10, 15,000 feet probably wouldn't be seen in Phoenix anyway, because Phoenix is ringed by mountains. And if I remember correctly, Phoenix is slightly below sea level. So in order to be able to see any lights in Phoenix that would have been flares, they would have had to have been set off at 25,000 feet at that altitude. So that makes me very suspicious. one aircraft, an A-10, goes up and drops a pattern of flares, and they go out, and that's the end of it. How lucky is that for the Air Force or whoever wants to obfuscate this particular incident, you know, an hour and a half later? Now you got something that you can throw out there that can muddy up the waters whenever you need it to. And the press fall into that one every time. So the thing is to focus on what happened between 7:30 and 8:30, and to hell with the flares. You know, they're not important.
And that's what the media, as I said, have been focusing on.
Yeah,
is those
I think it was deliberate. Now, I know most people don't bother with it. They just say, well, you know, it was an unfortunate thing. They were out there doing an exercise. I don't think they were out there doing an exercise at all. I think they were ordered. One aircraft was ordered up to 25,000 feet or more to drop flares that would ignite at 25,000 feet so they could be seen over Phoenix. I think that's what happened.
The commander of the Air National Guard in Maryland, many, many months later, suggested that the pilot didn't want to come home with those flares and decided to dump them.
Yeah. That's not his call.
No, of course it isn't.
And there's no reason for him not to. I've heard that same nonsense, too, that it was dangerous for them to land with flares on board. That's nonsense. You know, most aircraft, you know, that are attack aircraft, fighter aircraft, and so on, carry flares as a defense measure against missiles. They're fired from the aircraft. They zip around, they're sort of irregular in their flight pattern, mm-hmm. to draw away a heat-seeking missile. They don't fire these things off before they land every time because it might be dangerous. That's nonsense. They're not dangerous. They land, they're used again another time. Those things cost about $1,000 a piece. Every time they went up to do an exercise, and this is the Air Guard we're talking about, not the main Air Force. Main Air Force has more budget money than the Air Guard will ever think about having. Then the next one was, I heard that the ordnance officer told him, well, just get rid of your flares. His reason for that was he didn't want to have to log them back into the into ordnance, you know, when it got back down.
Yeah.
He didn't want to make a paper entry. Now, come on. It's, you know, it's amazing the kind of nonsense that they'll come up with, you know. Anyway, they did their job, and for 10 years it worked, but I don't think it works anymore.
Apparently not. And
no.
You are a pilot, admittedly civil aviation, but military aviation has always been a fascination of yours, so you have done an enormous amount of research just because you love to fly,
yeah.
and those kinds of things interest you, into what goes on in military aviation, the types of aircraft, what orders are, et cetera, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera.
Even if the military is a military air arm, you know, the Air Force, and we're on the commercial side or the private side, doesn't mean that we don't know what each other's doing. Often we know more about what the Air Force is doing than they know about what we're doing, but the fact of the matter is you just get to know airplanes. Like a car collector, I guess you know obscure models of vehicles that were made way back in the 1910s and 20s that nobody else has ever heard of, but you know what they are, and you can identify them by a look. And when the flare thing first came out, I decided, well, let's have a look at flares and see what they're all about. So I started researching flares, and it's called the LUU-1 is the first model, LUU-1, and there's the LUU-2, and there's different types of flares to do different things, but the ones we're concerned about are parachute flares. Some of them could be actually preset right in the aircraft. Others are preset on the ground by a little knob on the end so that no matter what altitude you eject them from, he deploys the parachute first and then ignite until it reaches a certain altitude above mm-hmm. the ground. In
right.
other words, between 1,500 and 500 feet, so that people on the ground can actually make use of these things.
These things then must have been set manually on the ground to go off at whatever height it was that they went off.
Yeah, preset to go off at 25,000 feet on the ground. Before they left the ground. See, that's an important point. Why would they deploy flares? Just so to say, well, I went up and I deployed flares, now I know how to do that? That's nonsense. The work's all done for you. All you have to do is press a button and the damn things pop out of there, right? So, there again, they were deliberately set to go off at 25,000 feet. The A-10 is not one of the aircraft that can preset it in the air. The A-10 is a very basic airplane. Everybody, that's the Warthog, the Thunderbolt,
mm-hmm.
the one with the Gatling gun in the nose. This is a very basic airplane. The control surfaces work on the airplane the same way as they do on a Cessna. They've got cables in there, although they have double sets of cables in case one gets shot away. The inside of the airplane is very bare bones. It's a low-level aircraft. It's meant to do what it does, is to kill tanks and so on, but it can also draw flares, supposedly, so they can draw flares over a field where there's some tanks, and then they can go and shoot them up, I guess. But don't forget, this was just over 10 years ago now. But still in all, these had to be preset, so they'd have to know what the altitude was of the ground, how far it was above sea level. because they're a barometric thing, so they'd have to allow for that, too, when they were preset on the ground.
It's intriguing that, to my knowledge, none of this has come out in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they were the type of flares that had to be specifically set on the ground to go off at a certain height.
Yeah, well, I had brought it up years and years ago when this first happened. I mentioned it when I started researching.
Yeah, but none of this has come out, other than perhaps you had mentioned it on the UFO updates list 10 years ago. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I've mentioned it different times over the years, but never anywhere where it would probably be picked up or even paid attention to. I sent an email off to the person, I can't remember the name now, who mentioned about Fife Symington having seen this thing, you know, when...
Well, Leslie Kane broke the story.
Yeah, well, that was that one, but this is another one by Mary somebody yesterday with having my emails in front of me. I can't tell you. Her email address is right at the bottom of the piece, so I sent her a message bringing up this thing about flares and how they press continuously mixes up the two sightings. Well, they put the two of them together, and the 10 o'clock flare sighting is tainting the 7:30 to 8:30 sightings over Phoenix. They had nothing to do with the 7:30 to 8:30 sighting, but it sure did work.
It certainly did, didn't it?
I don't hesitate in saying this was pure disinformation. I think that it was deliberately done in order to obscure. The same way as they, you know, use the old, the Air Force used the old dummies in
Roswell.
Yeah, at Roswell, when the dummies weren't even made until 3 or 4 years later. Mm-hmm. I think it was 1953 they first used them, which was 6 years after the event, you know. But that got thrown in there, and that still continuously shows up in newspaper articles. Some of these UFO documentaries that are on that they don't do any research whatsoever. Gets thrown into the mix as being how silly we all are to even buy into any of these things. And
it all happened 12 years after the Roswell incident.
12 years, yeah. Thing I think, pure and simple, that at 10 o'clock that evening, and let's face it, they had plenty of time. They're reacting an hour and a half later to something that happened where people are phoning in. They're probably, NORAD was probably getting all kinds of calls. And don't forget, the ones we're not going to hear about. How do we know that they didn't have aircraft in the air themselves that, over the Barry Goldwater range doing exercises at between 7:30 and 8:30 in the evening and saw something themselves? And then all of a sudden, you know, the news reports start coming in. People are on their phones. They're calling their TV stations over in Phoenix.
The radio stations are all covering it.
The radio stations are alive with this stuff.
Yeah.
They don't live in a vacuum. Somebody was probably calling them up to begin with and asking them, are you guys doing something over there? Because we've got these things over Phoenix right now. So the next thing, it gets bumped up the ladder to the next commanding officer above, you know, and say, well, what are we going to do about this? Apparently there's something going on over there. How do we respond to this, you know? And then... And before you know it, they're getting a call from somebody, I don't know, National Security Agency or somebody like that, come back and do something, you know, to drop some flares or something. You know, I don't know. I know this is pretty rough, but it would not surprise me to hear that had happened, because I can't think of any good reason for at 10 o'clock in the evening for them to go up and drop flares that would ignite at 25,000 feet. And as I mentioned in an email a couple of weeks ago, I got an email from a fellow offline who was a tech on Granite back during the Vietnam War, who used to load flares into aircraft. Now, they were a different type of flare back then. They weren't as sophisticated as they are now. Not that they were not sophisticated, but he said we never had any good reason to have flares ignite at 25 or 30,000 feet. I can think of no good reason for the Maryland Air Guard to be in the air dropping flares and having them ignite at 25,000 feet at 10 o'clock in the evening just for the sake of dropping a pattern of flares, other than obfuscate the incident that had happened between 7:30 and 8:30. And that's my take on it.
Thank you, Dave. And a good take it was, too, Don Ledger. I appreciate all the time and energy that you put into this program and to all the work that you put into ufology in general. And we'll talk to you in a couple of 3 weeks.
Well, thanks, Errol. And sure, drop back in or call me anytime. Enjoy doing the show.
And I enjoy doing it with you. Thanks, Don.
Goodbye.
The other story, which also broke in the press this past week, has been the release of about 400 files by the French Space Agency, and those files are online if you can access the website. To fill us in a little bit more on what those files may contain, we head across the pond to France. And French UFO researcher, independent author, Gildas Bourdais joins us. Bonjour, Gildas.
Bonsoir. it is bonjour for you.
It is.
For me, it is bonsoir. You
know? Well, vive la différence.
Right.
You've written 5 books on UFOs in the last few years. Have any of them been published in English?
No. No, I just had some articles published in English and made some speeches abroad. My first was in Brazil. There was a big symposium in, if maybe you recall that, organized by AJ Chevrolet in Brazil and Brasilia in 1997, and I was invited there.
Yes, I remember, because Stan Friedman and a whole bunch of North American researchers were there too.
Actually,
yes.
Stan and me were shared the same hotel room, you know, to, because there was not enough money for one room for each one.
I think that was when there was major discussion about the Varginha case too.
Right, it was the beginning of the Varginha case. It was very interesting.
Yes.
And I kept studying it. Actually, I translated in French the book of my friend Dr. Roger Lear. I translated it as he was writing it, chapter after chapter, so it was published in French before being published in English.
Well, sometimes the French are very, very fast, it would seem.
Well, it may happen. But not very often.
Yeah. So, let's talk about this recent release by the French Space Agency.
If you like, I can give a little brief history.
I'd love it.
So it started in 1997. It was called GEPAN at the time. It was a very good start in the beginning with engineer Claude Poher, and later with another engineer called Esther. It was the time when they had the chance to study some very good cases. The most famous remains the Trans-en-Provence case, which was the alleged landing of a small UFO in a garden in the south of France. It was very well studied, and there were effects on the plants around, etc. So it remains one of the best French cases. There was, in a little garden, a brief landing of a circular UFO, which left a circular trace on the ground. You don't remember that?
Vaguely, but I think I'm confusing
Trans-en-Provence.
Trans-en-Provence. I think I'm confusing it with a case in Quebec, which is very similar, where a small craft landed. There were beings came out of it, very small beings in some sort of suits, space suits, and they were gathering plant samples.
Uh-huh.
And the woman who owned the house was just dumbstruck. She just couldn't believe what she was watching. And she ran toward them, and they climbed back in their craft and shot off into the sky.
Is that one in Canada?
In Quebec, yes.
In Quebec?
Yes.
Oh, that's similar to another famous French case, which is the case of Cusac. They mention it on the website, which is now releasing files. It is given as one of the good examples of good cases.
Mm-hmm.
It was very similar to what you just said. It was small children who saw a UFO landing, and which departed soon after, and there were little beings, and even one of them, which is a very strange detail, seemed to have forgotten something and was left a little behind, but he rejoined the very UFO like jumping in the air on top of it. It's incredible.
These stories are so strange for a lot of people.
It is a very strange story. I have my little opinion about that. I have the hunch that there are some deliberately strange stories, purposely, you know, to baffle us, you know, to make us...
as if we're not baffled enough as it is.
Yes, maybe. Well, it might be something like that. There are not many, but there are some very good French cases, and all the rest is more ordinary. Some of these cases were embarrassing for the heads of CNES, the French Space Agency, and they decided to reduce the activity. And there was only one engineer left, Jean-Jacques Velasco, during many years, during the 90s, who did what he could, but couldn't do much. So it was more or less dormant toward the end of the 90s. But somehow this man, French Jean-Jacques Velasco, who was often criticized and even ridiculed by some people. Well, there is a French specialist to attack the officials who is Jean-Pierre Petit, who is a kind of maverick physicist who is very, very aggressive with everybody. So maybe this is why Jean-Jacques Velasco finally rebelled a bit. He decided toward the end of his career to write a book which was published in 2004, which was much more positive on UFOs than it was before. And the result was that they closed the CEPRA, his little service. They decided to close it in January of 2004. And he was put in the closet, as we say.
Yes, what happened to all the cases from that organization? Are they still...
Well, they were asleep in our sleeping archives, but they soon realized that they couldn't stop there. So as soon as September 2005, they created a new group called GEIPAN. It means in French, Groupe d'études et d'informations sur les phénomènes aérospatiaux non identifiés, which could be translated as Group for Study and Information on Unidentified Aerospatial Phenomena.
So that group got a hold of the dormant...
They still have all the files.
Oh, good.
And they are beginning to publish them now on the website. I may add something to give the general idea. There is a steering committee which is supposed to control the GEIPAN, which is presided over by an old general director of the French Space Agency, Yves Cigar. And he's a very, very good man, and he's been all the time much more positive on UFOs than his successors, who, as I explained, tended to reduce the activity. So this man is here again. He's now retired, but he has positive drive on the new service, you see. But there are some tensions between some people, so it is hard to say how all this is going to evolve.
The tensions are there among UFO researchers and organizations all over the world.
Exactly. And France is no exception.
Do you know if these papers are going to be translated into English, or do we have to use the online translators?
I don't think they are soon going to translate the whole thing because it is a very big volume. For the time being, they have released 400 cases, which cover the period of 1988 to 2005. But that's only 400 cases. In all, they have 1,650 cases with 6,000 testimonies. That's a lot of paper, about 100,000 pages. It's an enormous task already to scan all that, to clean them, to take out all the names and personal names and addresses and all that. So they have a big job on their hands already with that. So... they will be soon translated in English.
Yeah, I guess we're going to have to rely on Babel Fish's poor translations.
Well,
web, yes.
The engineer, Jacques Patel, has already warned that we are not going to find any new big case. The big cases are already known. Uh-huh. Now, another aspect I would like to stress here is that this new engineer is... at 59 years old, he's not very far from retirement, and obviously I have met him at a TV debate in Paris. He doesn't want to make waves, you see. He has, obviously, this directive, can I say that?
Yes.
Not to make waves. So he repeats all the time, well, we don't have any UFO secret, we are publishing everything. And there is no solid proof at all of the reality and the extraterrestrial nature of UFOs. But yesterday evening we obliged him to change a little bit this attitude. we oblige him to admit that if there are secret files, it just doesn't have them. They are in military archives.
I was going to ask if there were any military files in those.
Yes, in those
recent releases.
Files, yes, they were given back some old military files, back from the 50s and the 60s maybe. But I asked him yesterday, and he told me that there are not many. I know I am going to disappoint people by saying that. You know, some people have said that, oh, France released his secret file. No, this is wrong. Not so.
But that's the newspapers making it up as they go along, you know?
Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of foolishness going on.
Yes, as usual.
Yes.
It is hard to say how all this is going to evolve.
The tensions are there among UFO researchers and organizations all over the world.
Exactly. And France is no exception.
Do you know if these papers are going to be translated into English, or do we have to use the online translators?
I don't think they are soon going to translate the whole thing because it is a very big volume. For the time being, they have released 400 cases, which cover the period of 1988 to 2005. But that's only 400 cases. In all, they have 1,650 cases with 6,000 testimonies. That's a lot of paper, about 100,000 pages. It's an enormous task already to scan all that, to clean them, to take out all the names and personal names and addresses and all that. So they have a big job on their hands already with that. So they will be soon translated in English.
Yeah, I guess we're going to have to rely on Babel Fish's poor translations.
Well,
Web, yes.
The engineer, Jacques Patel, has already warned that we are not going to find any new big case. The big cases are already known. Okay. Now, another aspect I would like to stress here is that this new engineer is at 59 years old. He's not very far from retirement, and obviously I have met him at a TV debate in Paris. He doesn't want to make waves, you see. He has, obviously, this directive, can I say that?
Yes.
Not to make waves. So he repeats all the time, well, we don't have any UFO secret, we are publishing everything. And there is no solid proof at all of the reality and the extraterrestrial nature of UFOs. But yesterday evening, we obliged him to change a little bit this attitude. We obliged him to admit that if there are secret files, it just doesn't have them. They are in military archives.
I was going to ask if there were any military files in those.
Yes, in those
recent releases.
Files, yes, they were given back some old military files, back from the 50s and the 60s maybe. But I asked him yesterday, and he told me that there are not many. I know I am going to disappoint people by saying that. You know, some people have said that, oh, France released his secret file. No, this is wrong. Not so.
But that's the newspapers making it up as they go along, you know?
Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of foolishness going on.
Yes, as usual.
Yes.
The other argument that he has been saying the last few days that there is no proof whatsoever of UFOs. Yesterday, the journalist who was directing the debate, Yves Calvi, asked him very abruptly, do you believe that there are real UFOs? He was obliged to say yes.
Well, how could he not?
Yes, how could he not?
When you've got, 24% of the cases that have been put up online are marked as inexplicable.
Right. So, yes, now they have to admit that about a quarter of their cases are totally unexplained, which is quite a jump from previous figures, which were around 13%.
Yes.
Not so long ago. So they have been revising their stance quite a bit.
So over the next few years, we will see literally dozens and dozens more cases put up online, French cases.
Right. Yeah? Yes, certainly. Certainly. Yes. They are not going to stop now. They are going to finish the job.
Uh-huh.
The situation right now, as I'm talking, is not the end of the story. It's going to evolve in France.
And I think it's going to evolve all around the world, judging the way things have been going this year, as far as the media are concerned.
Yes.
Gildas Bourdais, I want to thank you very much for being with us on this podcast, and I'm sure that we'll talk again in the future.
All right. Thank you very much.
C'était un plaisir, monsieur.
Et pour moi aussi.
Au revoir, monsieur. Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Gildas Bourdais over there in France, a well-known, well-respected man over there, and a well-respected member of the UFO Updates email list. Two people that I've admired for a long time in my peripheral work as far as UFO research is concerned are Stanton T. Friedman and Frank Fascino. And Frank and Stan have been collaborating over the years on several interesting cases, which are about to come out in a brand new book by Frank Fascino. And Stan has written the foreword and the epilogue to Frank Fascino's new book, Shoot 'Em Down. And that's a fairly provocative title, isn't it?
Well, it should be. Hey, it's a provocative subject. When you find evidence, as we did, that military pilots were ordered to shoot down UFOs if they didn't land when instructed to do so, that is indeed a provocation in a lot of ways. And when we find evidence that there were hundreds of scrambles, and when I have heard stories that some of these went badly for the scrambler, then we're talking big stuff. And incidentally, the head of the American Rocket Society, Dr. Farnsworth, wrote a letter to President Truman at the time in 1952 saying he didn't think that was such a good way to respond to UFOs. So, yeah, it's appropriate. Most Americans have no idea that pilots were instructed to shoot down UFOs if they didn't. I mean, how are you going to tell a UFO to land? You point out from your fighter plane, point down, what is his response going to be? He'll go straight up.
So, in fact, there appears to be evidence that U.S. Air Force fighters went after UFOs and didn't come back?
I've heard seven such cases. I'm sure there are many more out there, but you can imagine the cover-up aspects of that. Frank and I tried to get accident reports on a number of cases, you know, 50 years later, and we had great difficulty. And the ones we got, well, you tell them, Frank, wasn't that one report we got, Del Curto and stuff, there were confusion all over the place. Contradictions, right?
Yeah, a lot of controversy, contradictions, lies, if you call it government lies. And another case that Stan and I have been working on occurred on August 5th of 1952 in Glastonbury, Connecticut, where there was some jets that went out on an alleged routine training mission, and one of the jets crashed outside of Hartford, Connecticut. Well, everything that was released in all the newspapers in Hartford, and including the New York Times, it was picked up on the AP wire, were controversial to what Stanton and I read in Norton Air Force Base documents that were just released. There was about a 100-page report. So we're finding what was released to the press and what is being told in these documents is completely on opposite ends. And whoever would have thought 50-something years later that we'd be comparing all these documents. And it's just not that one case. There's several cases.
Well, also, Errol, Frank found how many 200 and some cases in which airplanes crashed
between 1951 and 1956, this was just a little private study that Stanton and I worked on of the New York Times. And there was over 200 accidents where jets vanished, crashed on alleged routine training missions. And the majority of them were over the United States, Errol.
And I love those two words that were used, disintegrated and disappeared.
Ah.
Those are pretty strong words.
Over yes. the United States, mind you.
Yeah, and disappeared, and of course there are no reports of finding wreckage, or are there?
In some cases, but there were some where the disappearance was permanent and final.
Right, I'd never found any follow-ups to them.
Wow.
And incidentally, three of the pilots that crashed were guys who had flown over 100 missions in Korea where the MiGs were chasing them. There weren't no MiGs flying around the United States. That does seem a bit suspicious, incidentally.
Yeah, there's a lot of top fighter races. Matter of fact, one of the fellows who actually disintegrated in an F-100 Super Sabre was one of the fellows who was able to get off the air during Pearl Harbor in the attack and shot down a bunch of the Japanese intruders. He died in a mysterious accident.
So we're not talking about young guys going up for their first flight, in other words. We're talking about experienced pilots, and I should throw into here, I'm still working on finding out more, but one pilot came back and told his college classmate from Purdue University, he's in the early 50s, that while he was stationed in Germany as a pilot, we lost 20 planes to UFOs.
Mm.
And so this is the tip of the iceberg that the public has seen none of, really. And it's scary on the one hand, but for people who think that this is crazy, why would the government lie about all this stuff, you know, I should point out there's a wonderful book called By Any Means Necessary by William Burroughs, B-U-R-R-O-W-S. He talks about 166 military crewmen of reconnaissance flights that disappeared, were shot down, pushing toward the Soviet Union, China, and North Korea. This is back in late 40s, 50s, some in the 60s. There was nothing public said about what happened to these men. Their families were all lied to until 2001, where the government called a conference, if you will, and medals were given to the families who finally found out what happened to their husband or son or father or whatever. 166 men, and not one word in public that they were on reconnaissance missions near the enemy, so to speak, and were shot down in the course of duties. So it wouldn't surprise me at all, in view of that, and that's very well documented in Burroughs' 2001 book, that there are a host of such stories just waiting to be uncovered. And the trouble is, if they say that they were shot down by UFOs, then that makes UFOs real, doesn't it?
And there was a lot of mysterious cases that occurred in between 51 and 56. And I went over this with Stan at length, where there were anywhere between 2 and 5 different incidents, where 2 to 5 different crashes, that number of planes would all go down at once over the United States. 5 planes crashing, all hitting the ground in the same area. So there's at least a dozen different cases.
Wasn't there a report that 4 aircraft had all run out of fuel at the same time and gone down?
Yes, there are such stories. And, you know, does that sound realistic to anybody? You know, think about it for a minute. It doesn't to me. If you fill 4 cars with the same amount of fuel, they're not going to all run out of gas at the same place. It depends on the guy who's driving to some extent. And so remember, Errol, that what we're dealing with here is a consistent series of lies by the government since the 40s. If you look at my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, I have a paper, Government UFO Lies, there. And the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, the Air Force, they all lied about UFOs. So there should be no surprise here. What's surprising is they got away with it because the media wasn't doing its job. This year may be different.
It's certainly starting to feel different, isn't it? And perhaps as a result of Frank's book coming out, Shoot 'Em Down, there will be more interest on the part of the media in looking into these cases where United States Air Force fighters have been shot down.
Maybe, too. This isn't restricted to just the Air Force.
Oh, it isn't?
No. Frank, we've got some Navy cases there.
Navy and Marine.
Marine, too, yeah.
Right.
Them. Yeah, and the kicker here is that the public is very interested in this, but they're afraid of the laughter curtain. Well, we may have gotten lucky with that Chicago Tribune story about the sightings over O'Hare Airport, you know, January 1st. A million hits on their website, set a new record, astonished them to find that people were so interested, and I think that has had a real impact on the coverage of the release of the French files on UFOs, with the coverage of Fife Symington, the former governor of Arizona's admission that he had seen the early Phoenix lights, and I want to make a distinction between the 8 and 8:15 sightings of a huge triangular-shaped object that blotted out the stars, and the 10 o'clock flares dropped by the Air National Guard. He was a pilot, Symington was, and he held back. He ridiculed the subject, and now he's finally come out, and more power to Jim Fox and Leslie Keen for getting him to go public. And so the tone has changed, the tone of the coverage. I've looked at a whole bunch of articles on this French stuff, and it was amazingly decent. One article had the usual jibes about little green men, etc., but that was Time Magazine, which is to be expected based on their past history. But the New York Times, the Washington Post, Chicago Sun-Times, AP, UPI, they all had slightly different looks at it, but it was all fair and square, straight. That's remarkable, given the past history of misrepresentation on the part of the media.
Yes, and as you say, there is a huge amount of interest now in what's going on out there, just in the number of phone calls that I've taken from the media asking me to do interviews and reports, and the number of calls that you've had in just in the last couple of days, Stan Friedman, from media.
Yes, I've had a number of them, and I had five packed lectures over the past week in New York and Pennsylvania. The Reading, Pennsylvania Public Museum was sold out 2 weeks in advance for my lecture there. That's never happened, they tell me. The 92nd Street Y in New York, which is a main cultural center, they were surprised, I'll put it that way, very surprised by the response to my being there. And they charge a lot of money, like $25 a head for a lecture. So, and that's putting their money where their mouth is in terms of their interest and the people's. And so these are all good signs, and I guess what I'm hopeful of is something like My Lai. Remember, American soldiers had massacred some Vietnamese for their own best interests, of course. One guy tried to get the world to pay attention, had no luck until Seymour Hersh picked up the story, was carrying the New York Times all over the country, and suddenly other witnesses came out of the woodwork. And there were trials, Lieutenant Calley, Captain Medina. In other words, once you get a critical mass of people coming forward, if 20 Air Force pilots or Navy pilots or whatever, or crew members, came forward and said, yes, the planes went up, only one came back, two went up. They published a story later saying that an airplane had crashed in the ocean. Get enough people coming forward, the media can hardly ignore it. And what the government will do, who knows, probably some more lies. They've been getting away with it for all these years. Why stop now?
The thing that's intrigued me is the amount of print coverage that there has been, both over O'Hare and the Phoenix Lights and Fife Symington. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because the media realized that when they heard that O'Hare, that article got a million hits, and let's face it, print media are fighting a battle to the death with the internet and all the rest. You know, newspapers are losing circulation. So here's an area other than Iraq, which people are sick and tired of in more ways than one, I guess, where they hadn't realized that there was legitimate interest on the part of a lot of people. So I think they're putting their fears off to the side a little bit and recognizing that, hey, decent people are interested in this. I once did a classroom survey, 100 students. I said, I want you to vote with your eyes closed. So, and your instructor and I will count the votes. 80% thought most people didn't believe in UFOs, but 80% of them did believe in UFOs. But their actions were determined by their perception of how other people would react. It's the same with the media. I spoke to a bunch of Canadian editors in St. John at a conference a few years back. And the guy who arranged it said, boy, did you open a lot of eyes today. They didn't know there was any data out there, you know, so they were afraid of sticking their necks out. They were less afraid once they'd heard the facts, the data, the solid information. And I noticed that in the stories about the French stuff, nobody mentioned that the percentage of unknowns, which was about 28% according to one account, 24%, matches the Condon report had 30% unknown, Lubbock special report 14 had 21.5% unknowns, or to use the Air Force term, only those percentages.
Yes, only, yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, would they report on cures for cancer by saying, oh, I guess there isn't one because only 24% of the drugs work? You think about that for a
moment. Yes. The book, Frank,
yes.
I think originally, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think you started out rewriting the book, The Flatwoods Monster.
Right.
Have you included in Shoot 'Em Down any additional information about the Flatwoods Monster case, or have you gone over some of the older material on the Flatwoods Monster?
The first book was edited very heavily, and what I included is all that I have on the Flatwoods Monster. So what is in the new book is everything on the face of the earth concerning the Flatwoods Monster incident with additional material, and it is actually tied in. The book is actually the whole summer of 1952 now. Flatwoods is just a small segment of it. And this book is going to be the first concise book just on the summer of 1952 air wars involving the military. There were so many sightings that went on that year, you could write a million-page book on the summer of 52. Stanton and I worked together and concentrated just on the military aspect of it with the fighter jets. And I thought I knew a lot about that era until I started doing some hardcore investigation into it. And it actually surprised me. I had no idea what was actually going on.
Me too.
Stanton was able to get the Norton Air Force Base accident and safety research documents. That shed a whole new light on top of it. And I kept calling Stanton up for it at one point. It seemed like every day for weeks because I kept finding out certain areas within the United States that had a high concentration of sightings, and the main one was O'Hare Air Force Base in the Chicago area. So what was going on last year was just the tip of the iceberg of the culmination that led up to this, because during the summer of 52, they were visiting Chicago on a regular basis.
We should stress that O'Hare, yes, everybody knows it's a big commercial airport, but there are military planes out in that area, too, defending the big city and all that sort of thing, and training stations nearby. So there's a lot of military activity there.
A Sabre jet squadron was based there.
We should say that there's something else we need to take into account here. The context, and Frank does this in the book, that is, we were fighting a war, the U.S. was fighting a war in Korea, right? We were also anticipating that the Russians may be attacking any minute because they developed their nuclear weapons, and as it said in the 1951 National Security Council memo that I had that was declassified, they'd made more progress in the development of nuclear weapons and methods for delivering them in the past 18 months than had been expected for 5 years. And so there was honest anticipation. I mean, they knew that the radar coverage was inadequate. They set up the Ground Observer Corps, and we were getting ready to repel the invaders, you know. So we were very concerned about this, and we were making rapid changes in the armaments. And Frank found that the F-94C, one of our most advanced fighters, for example, switched from machine guns to rockets. And one has to presume that anybody intruding in your airspace wants to know as much as possible about your defense capabilities, right?
Right.
You know, and so there's a big switch from machine gun bullets to, what was it, Mighty Mouse?
Yeah, the 2.75s, and also, Stan, the Sabre jets, the Sabre Dog, the F-86D also carried those.
Yeah, so this
as
is
well
a big
as,
switch.
One of the Navy jets, the Cutlass, had a pod that attached, so you had three different jets in that era of 1952. Maybe it's a coincidence, Stan, but the F-94C was an all-weather night fighter, and that was unveiled in early July, and it was just a few weeks later that when the shoot 'em down orders were made public.
Incidentally, Earl, one of the things that pushed us to do this is that one outstanding UFO researcher had complained about Frank's first book, saying there were no dogfights. He knew all about the 52 wave. No dogfights between airplanes and UFOs and so forth. And that's when I called in the reserves and Barry Greenwell and Gross out on the coast and others supplied us with copies of clippings. And it was astonishing what was in the papers outside the New York Times and the Washington Post. And also our good old buddy General Roger Ramey was right in the middle of the...
The saucer man, as the New York Times called them.
To go back to O'Hare and Chicago for a moment, and more specifically Chicago, it should also be pointed out that the first nuclear research labs were underground at the
Stagg Field,
at
the
University of Chicago. Right. So another reason for them to be hanging out over Chicago back in those days.
Arlington National Lab is out there, too, incidentally, in the Chicago area. And, yeah, I mean, you want to keep tabs on the idiots down below here. And something that happened in 52 illustrates what was happening in the world. On October 31st, which is after the period of Frank's book of 52, we exploded the first hydrogen bomb. It was really ground exploded. It wasn't carried aloft. But the fireball for that thing was 3 miles wide. And that was 10 megatons. Hiroshima was 15,000 tons. This is the equivalent of 10 million tons of dynamite. So we were heading toward hell in a handbasket, if I can put it that way, and the Russians were exploding stuff. If you were an alien looking down on this planet, what were you thinking about what these idiots were doing?
Yeah.
They had a legitimate concern with, holy cow, these guys are harnessing energy. They're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare, but still, they could use this energy to come out and bother us.
Yes. If I were aware of the fact that there was a planet nearby that was developing really nasty weapons that could be used against us down here, then I, along with probably most of the population of the planet, would be really concerned. So why not come and check out what it is that the Earthlings are doing?
Yeah, and boy, look at the great, quote, progress, unquote, they have made.
Yes. Yes, we could potentially destroy ourselves back into a sub-primitive culture very quickly.
It may have been done a million years ago. We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when they came here to investigate and see what was going on, Stan, we were shooting at them. To
boot. Shoot first, ask questions later. And, you know, the funny thing is I had glimmers of this a long time ago. In McMinnville, Oregon, of all places, at Linfield College, where I was speaking, somebody there wanted to talk to me, so I said, sure. He was at a radar installation in Kalispell, Montana, in the early 50s, where the Canadians radioed down. There was a saucer heading their way. They had a fighter aloft for practice, maneuvers, whatever. They vectored him toward the UFO, and they watched on their screen as these two came together. And they never found any part of the fighter. They knew what altitude he was at, what direction he was flying, how fast he was going. He was never found. And what the guy told me, and this is very quiet, he wasn't looking for attention, was that after that, the word went out, don't shoot at them, take gun camera pictures.
Mm.
So this is a long time ago that I heard that story. And I've heard several more since, and most people have heard about the Cuban MiG case, where two planes went up after a UFO and asked the ground what they should do and were instructed to shoot it down. And the first pilot says he's armed his missile, he's got his radar lock on, and then the screaming second pilot says the first plane just disintegrated, and the UFO went from 30,000 feet up to 90,000 from Mach 1 to Mach several, changing direction. And the NSA asked for the tape, which they normally didn't do. They just took a transcript. And list the plane loss as equipment malfunction. I love that.
Well, yeah, swamp gas got in the fuel tanks.
Yeah, I mean, if your plane disintegrates, I guess it's correct to say there was an equipment malfunction. But this story I heard years ago. And so that's one of the seven. And what I'm getting at here is if anybody listening to this has any information, you know, a brother who said the other pilot went up and never came back, that kind of thing, we'd sure like to hear about it. My toll-free number, if you got something of the sort that we've been talking about to report, is 877-457-0232, or my email, fsphys@rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S, .com. Names won't be used without permission, but we'd sure like those bits and pieces of stories.
And the nice thing about doing a podcast is that we don't have to repeat it as we're talking, because the listener can just wind back if they want to hear that again.
That's great.
Stan, you and I, just to digress for a few moments, and it sort of applies to the work that's being done by everybody. You and I were at the Disclosure Conference here in Toronto at the University of Toronto.
Yes.
A couple of years back when Paul Hellyer, the former defense minister, spoke. And
yes.
I know that we all looked forward to what the former defense minister was going to have to say about UFOs and his time in office as the defense minister for Canada.
Yes.
When he got up there and started singing the praises of the day after Roswell, I looked at you and you sat there and I watched your shoulders slump.
Well, that's how I felt, that's for sure. This is the best he can do. And I asked him at the press conference whether he'd learned anything that was classified while he was defense minister, and he said no. So I don't think that's an adequate basis, in other words, for his conclusions, if you want an honest opinion. I just was terribly disappointed. He pointed to the Peter Jennings program, which I thought was really bad.
Yes, I'm not surprised.
And so it isn't a question of my disagreeing with the notion that aliens are visiting. I've certainly been saying that for 40 years now. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't evidentially oriented, if I can make up a phrase. And he hasn't said anything since. And the notion, picking up on the disclosure people, that we've back-engineered energy-saving devices, could save the world from global warming and all the rest of that stuff, and poverty, you know, throw in anything you want. There's no evidence that that's the case. At least I haven't seen any, and I don't think he's put any forward, and neither have the exopolitics guys.
Yeah.
Do you know of any?
No, not at all. As far as I'm concerned, and I know in speaking to a lot of UFO researchers, all that has been contributed by the exopolitics people and Paul Hellyer have been a large amount of mud in the waters.
Muddy waters, yes, indeed. No, you're right. And so I was disappointed by that. You know, it's like the Disclosure Project in general. Yes, they've dug out some very good witnesses. I don't doubt that. They've also done some that weren't so good, but they haven't used the government documents to establish, you know, the cover-up. Why not? How can you deny the government documents? I'm disappointed in those guys, and I don't quite understand what all is going on. Whose benefit is it for? And how about putting more evidence there? I did a rather scathing review of Dr. Weber's book some time back, because he made all kinds of claims about the aliens running the universe and running our planet and all that sort of thing. And Are we supposed to just take that on faith?
Apparently, yes.
Well, I can't.
No, and neither should any rational thinking person, even those who are in left field of left field, as the way many of us are supposed to be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know where they're going. I did see Fast Walkers. I'm in it. I was disappointed that there were people in it that I, frankly, have no reason to believe about anything. What was it? Sean David Morton and some other people that I don't consider in the high line of trustworthy individuals. Is that a nice way to put it?
A very polite way of putting it, Stan.
So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. There'll be people riding the current boom, if you will. But I think we need the media to get involved in the way that they are capable of getting involved to
yes.
really go after the facts and the data. And like I say, I was very encouraged by the coverage of the French stuff, the tone.
Yes, very much so. And I can only go by what I've been able to pick up from people such as yourself, because try as I might, I still can't get into their website. It keeps collapsing, crashing.
Well, hey, what do you expect? There's nobody's interested in this, you understand? But there are frustrations here. And on the other hand, I feel good about the fact that the press is finally looking and covering and asking questions and sort of shaking off the notion that this is only stuff for kooks and quacks and stuff like that.
Yes.
It's long overdue to do that, you mm-hmm. understand, but I'm optimistic. And there's another book coming out, a book by Kathleen Martin and myself on the Hill case, and it will be interesting to see how that is received. Captured is the title. The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And Kathleen is Betty's niece. She has all her papers and files and tapes and has transcribed all the tapes of the hypnosis sessions. And, you know, it's time for a redo. The first book, The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller, was 1966 and became a bestseller in many countries, as a matter of fact. But it's a lot of data that's never been published.
And that's going to be an interesting read. I'm really looking forward to laying my hands on a copy of that. And, of course, there's also Jesse Marcel's book, Roswell, It Really Happened.
Yeah, that's supposed to be available in Roswell at the 60th anniversary celebration. I'll be there. Kathy's in my book probably a little later than that, but in time for the MUFON conference where we both will be speaking. She'll be speaking about the Hill case. I'll be talking about 60 years of Roswell, as you can imagine. So this could be a very big year, and with this present attitude of interest and a little more acceptance, this could shake up all the structures that have kept this story from getting the attention it deserves. I don't mean the Hill story. I mean the whole UFO thing. And it'll be interesting to see the measures taken by the government and the Sikopians, who will be fighting tooth and nail to attack all this. You've already seen James McGahey attacking Symington's story.
Oh, yes, the astronomer.
Yeah, he was also an Air Force pilot and a whole hundreds or maybe thousands of parachute jumps.
I got an email from an astronomer, which I actually posted to the UFO updates list, who said that he knows McGahey, or McGraha,
yes.
is a very close-minded individual.
Well, that same astronomer, incidentally, I spoke at his college, Pima College East Campus in Arizona, and there were nasty letters to him from some other people on campus about bringing me in to speak.
Oh.
And fortunately, David Ayatovaya defended me and held on to bringing me in. But their approach was, you ought to have McGahey speak. He took care of that. Well, I fortunately sent David the tape of my two-hour debate with McGahey at Middle Tennessee State University. We did a full, formal two-hour debate. Are flying saucers real? Copies are still available. They're listed on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. But once David had seen that, which was McGahey in full bloom, he recognized that the guy hadn't done his homework. was doing his research by proclamation.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, he's not an astronomer. He's an amateur astronomer.
Well, yeah, but he does have his own fancy building there.
Oh, yeah?
With a good-sized telescope in it.
Well, that qualifies him to comment on UFOs, doesn't it?
Of course it does. He was in the Air Force, and he never saw anything, he says. I don't know whether to believe him or not.
Just like Phil Klass never saw anything, but we know different.
Well, what can I say? I was interested to see that comment because I was glad that David had courage enough to come forward with that. You can't let the nasty, noisy negativists get away with this garbage. They have to be challenged. And I'm sure Frank's book is going to bring out some of these people, just as the first book did. But we've got the data to back it up. And incidentally, Frank's book is very much illustrated, not just because Frank is an outstanding artist, but because he's dug out newspaper articles and all kinds of good stuff. There are more illustrations than they can possibly use in publishing the book.
Speaking of astronomers, I also was able to get hold of a big astronomy organization in the Charleston, West Virginia area, who backed up Stan and I's research about the 18 and a half hours of alleged meteor sightings, that there were no meteor crashes that particular night on September 12, 52. And there was only three recorded crashes in the state of West Virginia's history.
Meteorite
landings, and none of them occurred on September 12th or 13th.
And, of course, only those meteors buzzed around the sky, changing direction and elevation and height.
18 and a half hours, which was said to be one meteor seen for 5 to 6 seconds.
And it landed on top of the hill. Joe Nickel will tell you it came down on top of the hill and along with that 6-foot owl.
Yay, Cyclops.
That scared the kids. And, you know, we, Joe Nickel and I, were both on your show one night in a rather nasty exchange, as
yeah.
I recall.
Yes.
And he's got explanations for everything, and he showed up in some of these television documentaries. I think I was in 4 of them over a 2-month period, and they were mostly pretty bad, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have the nasty, noisy negativists doing their research by proclamation, including Joe.
Dr. Joe Nickel, can you give us a bit of a backgrounder on the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal?
I like to point out that investigation is our middle name. We look into paranormal claims and fringe science claims. By paranormal, we mean those things that are beyond the normal range of science and human experience. It's a broad umbrella that would include all of the supernatural, but also include such things as UFOs or the Loch Ness Monster, which, if they existed, might be perfectly natural. My own personal philosophy is that we should neither be close-minded debunkers nor credulous mystery mongers. We should carefully investigate paranormal claims with a view toward solving them.
And here you have the nasty, noisy negativists doing their research by proclamation, including Joe, and, you know, they did an experiment. They shot down the balloons in a simulated mogul balloon, and sure enough, there ain't nowhere near enough material to account for what the rancher said and what Jesse Marcel said about how big an area was covered.
Frank Fischina, when is Shoot 'Em Down due out?
We're shooting for within the next 2 months, and I have updates on flatwoodsmonster.com, and I have a filament electronic copy of my book right now, but the full-blown expanded version will be in paper form within approximately 2 months. And if you go onto my website, I'm going to have updates on there pretty regularly.
And there is an email address, presumably, at flatwoodmonster.com.
Yes, right on the homepage, and I have a YouTube little video on there right now, and I'm actually putting together another one real in the near future.
Oh,
and
awesome.
It's going to have some tie-ins to the Shoot 'Em Down.
Stan Friedman out there in Fredericton, New Brunswick, thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
As always, it's my pleasure. And Frank Fischino, I look forward to your book, Shoot 'Em Down, and keep on that research. It's astounding what can be found if you do the work and not shoot your mouth off when you know nothing about things, isn't it?
This is the tip of the iceberg. We're just starting into this.
Thank you both, gentlemen.
Alrighty.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As I was standing looking up one day, enjoying the view across the way, some big bright lights came flying by, a lot of whirling doodads in the sky. It's just imagination, but I saw them just the same.
And as usual, every couple of weeks we head down to Alabama. Alfred Lemberg lives down there and always has something to say about what's gone before on the program. Hello, Alfred.
Hey, Errol. Great program. Stan and Frank Vecino were just off the scale of astonishing things that they had to report.
Yes, pretty amazing stuff. And most of it, not something that people have heard before.
No, not at all, especially some of the minor points, major points. But Stanton Friedman offering up these little gems of knowledge that, when looked at in a certain reasonable way, just really can blow the top of your head right off. One of these things was the Farnsworth letter that he referred to. After all of this time, and perhaps even some months of this shoot-down order that the Air Force had when confronting an unidentified flying object that refused to land for them, and Farnsworth publishing this letter and kind of intimating the idea that it might not be a very good idea to try to shoot these things down at all. And then Stanton mentioned what you need to do, and I guess this was part of the quote, don't shoot bullets at them, get gun camera footage,
mm-hmm.
right?
And did they listen?
And that's the point. Can you imagine the absolute treasure trove of stuff that must be hidden in some vault somewhere with regard to these gun cameras?
Absolutely. And there have been rumors for many years that there was gun camera footage of all kinds of objects, but have we seen any of it?
Well, we have seen a few tantalizing bona fide gun camera movies of unidentified objects.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the Farnsworth letter, you know, indicating that it might not be a good idea to shoot these things down, basically because, geez, if they can get here, they can kick our butts. But that's another story altogether.
Mm-hmm.
The things that Stanton and Frank were talking about with regard to Frank Vecino's new book, Shoot Them Down, his interest, Frank, essentially his interest being piqued with the seven cases of destroyed aircraft that were just pretty much laying around, meaning that there was some knowledge of them. And then Friedman and Vecino working together on that short study they did of the New York Times, and all of a sudden discovering 200-plus destroyed aircraft that were vanished, had crashed, had disintegrated in flight.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about all of this was that these were not just Johnny-come-lately persons that they were throwing in the cockpits to fly. No, these were war-experienced, seasoned pilots that really knew what they were doing.
World War II, Korean vets,
and
yes.
Korea, too, yeah, exactly. And, you know, really what's so interesting about this, and you look at all of this information that they're uncovering and all of these dots that it's, I mean, really no stretch to connect them at all, is that we have to remember at all times that what this is all about is the potential for toe-to-toe interplanetary warfare with beings from beyond, you know? You can say that the outcome of that conflict has been very graciously indecisive. Okay, if you're not saying that in the final analysis we lost that war, they kicked our butts.
And without any problem at all.
None.
And why they didn't continue to kick our butts and kick civilian butts, one can only guess at.
Well, I think it kind of speaks better to them than it does to us, because we pretty much kind of initiated all of that behavior with our hubris. And all of this points directly, when they're always saying, and you hear it all the time, that there's no national threat, they're not doing threatening things or being threatening in any way, when there's this history that Frank Vecino has uncovered, when there is this history that Richard Dolan has uncovered, when there is this history that Stanton Friedman has uncovered, and that dozens of quality individuals have uncovered, and there we are.
And there we are indeed. I'm really looking forward to having a hard copy of Frank's book.
Well, actually, I do have pretty close to what the hard copy is. My prediction is that it's well worth the wait.
And I don't read hard copy too much anymore. You know, I just simply don't have the time. So it's list and various blogs and websites and podcasts.
Yes. You know, some of the other things that Stanton Friedman pointed out, that it would be impossible to keep a secret this big when we have ample evidence that, well, certainly not as big as UFOs and what is flying them, but equally big secrets that were kept, vis-a-vis that Dr. Burroughs book, By Any Means Necessary, that Stanton Friedman referenced,
yeah,
indicating proof positive that big secrets can be kept.
Absolutely, and big secrets have been kept forever, man.
And some of the other things that he brought up, vis-a-vis his work with Frank, the multiple aircraft from multiple service agencies, Army Air Corps, New Air Force, the Navy, the Marines. Again, all of these seasoned aviators flying, sometimes in flights of four, all of them running out of fuel at the same time?
Yeah, well,
all of them crashing into a mountain in formation at the same time? I don't think so.
Neither do I. And it's just more stories, in quotation marks.
Exactly. On an up note, as far as Stanton Friedman is concerned, he was very inspiring, actually, about his expressed hopes for a new year, vis-a-vis that documentarian James Fox and Leslie Keene, both of them outing Symington in a way that I think that has got to have some kind of legs, don't you?
I would say so. And apparently James Fox, this coming week, is doing major media interviews along with Fife Symington.
Excellent. And I think this all speaks to something else that Friedman was alluding to, was this, just lately, I think we're seeing a refreshing new and, if not huge, interest in UFOs. If any indication that Friedman is packing lecture halls at $25 a head, you know, hundreds of people at a whack, this led to this interest that was going on and these more people becoming interested seemingly all the time, is this critical mass of witnesses that you can get to before really monumental and massive things start to happen. And leading to this is that increased coverage that Friedman alluded to, the facts that their newspaper websites are getting infinitely more hits and turning United States newspapers into online
publications,
and,
yes,
into world-class affairs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, great stuff.
It is.
And it's the first one to mention that this strange similarity to the amounts of knowns and unknowns with regard to the French having like around a 25% ratio of unknowns and
unexplained, yeah.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And Condon having 30% and Blue Book Special Report 14 like having 21.5.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a strange similarity that is across the board weird, because what everybody has to remember now is these unexplained sightings are not the worst sightings, they're the absolute best sightings involving the best people, the best qualified observer, the best observation times and techniques and experience. The folks listening have to really cop to that and understand that one in four is a huge amount of evidence.
Yes.
A startling amount of evidence. And as Friedman was talking about, that it's only that number, only one in four is a cure for cancer, you know, so nothing to get excited about.
And statisticians would have just a field day with those numbers, wouldn't
they? Oh, man, doing backflips.
Mm-hmm.
What we have to remember, too, getting back to Frank Pacino and his new book, is in no shape, way, manner, or form hardly anything that the old book was. And when you mentioned the old book to Frank, and he had this pause, this beat, and then he said, it was edited very heavily.
Yes.
And I really had to laugh out loud.
Yeah, I turned my mic down and laughed out loud.
Really?
When I asked him that question, I just wanted to establish the fact that, in fact, it wasn't a rewrite of the old book. It was a brand new book.
Yeah, it is a brand new book.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any comparison at all, it's the fact that the new book certainly corrects a list of 106 substantive errors. Read really like a who's who of faithless incompetence and insentient pruning and paring of a manuscript, you know, of lists and photos and diagrams and killer drawings and no index and seeming professional impropriety and slash and burn editing and it just went on and on and on and on to the point where it wasn't the book that it was supposed to be. It wasn't the book that was written, and there was a potential loss to Frank Fascino's reputation that was just not right, you know?
Yeah.
Because he wrote a better book than that.
Yes.
But like we've been saying, the errors are corrected. The book is whole, is complete. It phoenix-like has risen from its own ashes. It's getting ready to sail, I'm sure. And again, unbelievable things that he is able to demonstrate and work out rationality to. It's not far from toe-to-toe interplanetary war, as I was saying before.
Very much so.
It has to open up more eyes than, smarter eyes than mine, I would think.
Mm.
I had kind of the impression, and I think everybody who got the report, too, about the French files, was that, okay, the French are coming clean, they're just doing everything they got on the table, and no, they are not doing anything like that. I was so disappointed. That was part of the bucket of cold water that I got from Gilda Bourdais when he spoke.
As we pointed out during the course of our conversation, it's the newspapers that have been saying secret UFO files.
What's up with that? What's up with that constant misdirection that Don Ledger was pointing out? These newspapers, you'd think they'd have a little more impetus to get the story right. They're supposed to be newspapermen, journalists, after all.
The problem is there's very little research on behalf of journalists nowadays. They don't have the time. You know, every newspaper is short-staffed. Everybody's covering off different beats.
The point is, what's underneath all of this misdirection? They simply have to be knowing what they're doing and what they're not reporting and what they're not seeing. I mean, when the government of a freaking state comes out and says, oh, yeah, 10 years ago I lied for my reasons, but I have to tell you now and come clean that there was really something out there, and I saw it. You know, I saw the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, whoa. I mean, that's just got to back you up.
Yeah.
And part of that new hope that Stanton Friedman was talking about earlier, I think.
I'd like to think that it encourages retired military and civilians, pilots, people whose pensions likely would have been affected if they'd spoken up 10 or 15 years ago.
Right.
I'd like to think that they will be encouraged to speak up now.
Me too. Listener, I offer every encouragement, because what it really is, it's that critical mass of witnesses that Stanton Friedman was talking about, and the point where everybody being just a little bit brave, so no one person has to be consummately brave. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes. Bravery en masse.
Really, I mean, you know, if all of us are just a little bit brave, we can move to the asteroid belt. We can live in cities between the stars. It's all right there in our grasp. It's at hand. The kingdom is at hand.
Hooray for the kingdom!
Thanks for letting me rave. Or no, you're probably going to cut that out.
Oh, probably. And how about Don Ledger? He's just done some extraordinary looking into flares.
And done some unbelievable work that I'm very appreciative of. Extremely knowledgeable, very well researched, a clear demonstration that the flares are obviously some kind of red herring, that pilots would not worry about landing with a munition like that, and that they would not have to worry at all about having to do anything like re-log ammunition and stuff like that. Pilots don't get involved with that stuff. And the biggie was that the flares had to be preset to go off at that altitude.
Exactly.
I'd forgotten that myself.
Yes, they had to have landed. The barometric triggers had to be set for a specific height so that they would go off at It doesn't matter what height you drop them from, they'll go off at whatever height you tell them to.
That's a big 10-4. So his point about why are the sightings all confused, we were talking a little bit about that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wondered, could it be possible that the flares are, you know, and I put big quotes around that, are the only real video that they have? So that's what they run when they talk about this thing on television.
You have to remember that the event has become known as the Phoenix Lights now, too. So How are things in your town before we wrap it up? Enterprise, Alabama, that was hit by that tornado a few weeks ago.
Well, actually, everybody, you know, kind of came together and seemed to pull through it as well as can be expected. You know, we're kind of like taking second seat anymore because there have been so many other disasters down in the heartland of the United States with regard to tornadoes and, you know, bad storms and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Things are getting curiouser and curiouser, as Lewis Carroll once said.
They are indeed stranger and stranger.
Indeed. That brings me to a close, actually, Errol.
It wouldn't be a close without that Alabama fog whistle. Thank you, Alfred Lemberg.
Always good talking to you, and look forward to the next time, Errol.
Be a couple of weeks before we do this again.
Up in the east of
Bye, Alfred, and thanks. As somebody used to say, there certainly is much going on around us lately, and it seems that UFOs are finally attracting some major attention. We'll see how that attention plays out in the coming weeks. I want to remind you that this program wants and needs your input, either by email to sdi@virtuallystrange.net, or by recording your comments, UFO reports, or a sound clip that you'd like other listeners to hear. Let others know how you feel about this program and what's going on in the UFO world. My thanks to you for having your ears open, and to the contributors to this week's podcast, Dave Furlott, Don Ledger, Gildas Bourdais, Frank Fascino, Stanton T. Friedman, and Alfred Lemberg. May your skies be clear and intriguing, and enjoy your week.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Kit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.